Hello, and welcome to our micronutrients presentation on phosphorus. Phosphorus is one of those minerals that's really important in the body. We have, you know, makes up bones and a lot of other things, and we'll go through that today. But it also, in excess, can be problematic. So we're going to go through phosphorus from the standpoint of what it is, how it's absorbed, how it's digested, where it's used, what kind of forms there are, and then therapeutically how you would use it with folks and determine if they have a deficiency. Phosphorus deficiency is not real common, but phosphorus excess is actually more common. So let me go here. So before I start, I like to start with a medical disclaimer that anything that I'm sharing is not meant to replace one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, not medical advice. And I say this because a lot of you, you're all here because you're practitioners and you want to learn and learn how to do this with your clients and patients, but also because you might hear things that apply to you, and we're always our own practitioner, right? We're always working on ourselves. So, you know, just taking it that sometimes some of the things I may say may sound and resonate with you, but if you are on medication or you're working with somebody who's on medication, make sure that they're aware that, you know, they should bounce these ideas across the practitioner who prescribed them before putting them into action. So let's take a look at phosphorus. So phosphorus is an essential macronutrient, macro mineral, meaning that we need it in large quantities, right? We don't need it in microgram amounts. We need it in milligram amounts, and we actually need it in the multi-hundred milligram amounts. It's the second most abundant mineral in the body, second only to, guess what? Calcium. And guess what the two major minerals are that make up bone? Calcium. So it's really obvious, calcium and phosphorus. So it's really obvious why we have so much of it in our body. It actually makes up about 1% of the body weight, stored mostly in the bones and teeth, about 85%. So similar to calcium, they work together. But we're going to find out today is that excess phosphorus can actually cause bone demineralization, and it can throw off the calcium balance in other ways. So what does phosphorus do then? Of course, it's bone mineralization. Yes. What else? It's important in the production of energy. We're going to look at some pathways where it's involved in ATP production and Krebs cycle. You're going to hear a lot of terms called phosphorylation and adding phosphorus to chemicals and molecules can actually be very productive in a lot of body functions, right? So it's important in acid-alkaline balance. And it also helps to manage kidney function and filter waste. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, some more in the general phosphorus area. It was actually first isolated back in 1669. That's a long time ago. And it was done during various alchemy trials. The name came from the Greek phos, meaning light, and phoros, meaning bearer. So bearer of light, bringer of light. It's in a lot of soft drinks. It's also high in meat. So in our society where people eat a lot of fast food, a lot of hamburgers, a lot of meat, and a lot of soft drinks, phosphorus excess can be very problematic and demineralizing for the bones. So let's look at the chemistry of phosphorus. I know we're not here to be chemistry majors, and I know that in my training, we spent a lot of time on chemistry and a lot of time on things I didn't see the clinical relevance for. So when I teach you the chemistry of these things, I'm teaching you from a standpoint of understanding the clinical relevance. Sometimes it's just because I want to geek out and there's some really interesting things, but most of the times I'm going to try to make clinical significance so that you understand and can read medical literature. That's another piece. It's the 15th element in the periodic table. The symbol is P. The molecular, you know, weight and number are on the symbol. It's a vital part of everything. It's not a metal, and it's part of the nitrogen family. As a gas, it's colorless. So some metals obviously have a gaseous form. It's a colorless gas. As a solid, it's silvery, white, or red. And that depends on how the bonds are formed. And you're going to see as we go through this, there's a lot of different bonding possibilities in the ways that the phosphorus are presented in various molecules. It burns when exposed to air, so we actually store it underwater. And it has three allotropic forms, three forms in the solid form, white, black, and red. So in living organisms. Where do we find it? Where is it found in the body? Well, it's a part of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, ATP. What's that? Well, energy, ADP, adenosine diphosphate. And when we take in glucose, when your clients take in glucose and it gets into the cells by, hopefully they have good insulin and insulin receptors, and sugar gets into the cells, then what? Well, we need oxygen and a bunch of other nutrients, particularly a lot of B vitamins and amino acids, to produce ATP. And we went through that cycle, the Krebs cycle, in very good detail in one of our first modules. Phosphorylation activates enzymes, hormones, and cell signaling molecules. So the term we use for adding phosphorus to a particular molecule is phosphorylation. And you're going to hear that term used a lot. And if you read medical studies and literature, you're going to hear that used a lot. The bones are made mostly of calcium phosphate, and that's the symbol for it, Ca3, so three calciums. Phosphorus and phosphorus and four oxygens, and then two of those. So that's what the molecular structure is. It also binds to hemoglobin in the red blood cells and regulates the oxygen delivery to the tissues in the body. So it really has a couple of different roles when it comes to energy formation, right? Hemoglobin, which carries oxygen to the cells, so phosphorus is important there. It's also part of the ATP energy molecule. So it's really important in energy production. And we don't always think of it that way. So let's look at some of the functions of phosphorus. Well, like we said, major structural component of bone in the form of calcium phosphate salt called hydroxyapatite. And that was that formula we just showed you. Some people ask me, like, what's the best form of calcium to take? Well, the best form of calcium to take is a form that also includes other important bone nutrients. And you can actually do supplements of calcium hydroxyapatite, but it also would have the phosphorus because it's actually the structural component of bone. Phospholipids. What are phospholipids? Well, we see that all the time. So it's important in nerve transmission. Phospholipids like phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine, phosphatidylinositol, and phospholipids are major structural components of cell membranes. And in particular, their claim to fame is in nerve membranes. So phospholipids are important for membrane. That would be acetylcholine. The choline part is pulled away from the phosphatidyl. And so it's a carrier for that. It's important for, like, the myelin sheaths around the nerves. Phosphatidylserine is important for maintaining cortisol levels and bringing them down, but also repairing the hippocampus, which gets damaged during long periods of stress. So these phospholipids are super, super important. It's also important, as we said, for energy production and the storage, because we need to have these phosphorylated compounds like ATP to store the energy and then be used, and creatine phosphate. So DNA and RNA are actually long, you know, winded strands around each other of phosphate-containing molecules. And then, of course, it helps. It's an important buffer for acid-base balance. So when the body detects the balance of pH going down in the blood, remember, we're supposed to keep it at 7.435 to 7.45. And when we detect that that's going more into the acidic formation, we're looking for acid-base balance. We're looking for buffers to bring that back up into the range. And bone contains a lot of that. Of course, we hope that the body has enough of those minerals in the bloodstream. So things like phosphate and calcium and magnesium and zinc, those can all be excess in the blood floating around, so we don't have to break down bone. But that seems to be the best repository of these alkaline minerals. And when person is eating foods or stressing out or doing a lot of medication, which puts them more into the acidic form or the acidic balance, we're going to start to break down bone. And that's one of the dangers of it. So let's look at digestion, and then we'll look at the storage and absorption and all that. So most of the phosphorus that gets put into the body is absorbed in an organic form, and it's hydrolyzed enzymatically. Hydrolyzed, right? You add water to it to help break the bonds in the small intestinal lumen. And then it's released as inorganic phosphate. So when we say it's an organic form, it's bound to carriers that are organic in nature. Phospholipase C is a zinc-dependent enzyme, And it hydrolyzes the glycerophosphate bond in phospholipids. So it's an important, but it's an enzyme that depends on it, on the phosphorus. And also there's alkaline phosphatase, which is a zinc-dependent enzyme. And we see that reported on our lab tests, right? And when we see that being very low, it could be an indication that there's low zinc. Its activity is stimulated by what? Calcitriol. What's calcitriol? Calcitriol is actually vitamin D, the active form of vitamin D. It functions at the brush border of the enterocyte to free phosphorus in some bound forms and can't free the phytate-bound phosphorus. So if we're taking in phosphorus and wanting to break it down and use it, and it's an organic compound, if it's bound to phytates, the alkaline phosphatase can't really break it apart. So let's look at absorption. It's readily absorbed in the small intestine. So it's not one of those nutrients where you have to take huge amounts in order to get the amount you need. The intake from the food goes into the small intestine, and then we excrete, it looks like, about a third of what goes in. So we're maintaining and absorbing about 67%. And that may seem like, wow, that's not efficient, but if you remember from some of the other nutrients, it's actually quite good, because some of them, like B12, we may only absorb 10% of what we take in. Okay, so the net absorbed in the intestine is 21, and that goes into the extracellular fluid. And then the kidneys will filter out, and there's usually about 21 in the urine that's excreted. So we keep in phosphorus balance in the body. We take in, we utilize it, and we excrete, and we maintain the phosphorus balance. Sometimes we want to be taking in more and keeping more. So, and then it gets put into the bones. So that's basically the absorption of phosphorus. Let's look at some more about the phosphorus absorption. About 50 to 70%, so we said about 67%, but right in that range, between a half and two-thirds of the dietary phosphorus is absorbed. The animal sources tend to be absorbed in the upper end of the range, which actually can be problematic. For some things, having absorption in the upper range, which are not very available in the diet, can be problematic. But in the case of phosphorus, we see a lot of people who have overloaded phosphorus because of the soft drinks and the excess meat consumption. The phytate-containing foods, which could be grains and some beans and some of the veggies, can mostly be grains and beans, though. They're at the lower end of the absorption because the phytate actually binds some of the minerals and takes them out. There is some more recent research that I have yet to look into in depth that is indicating that there's some benefits to phytates in foods, but the traditionally held opinion is that the phytates bind minerals and take them out of the body. So the absorption is primarily happening in the small intestine, in the duodenum and the jejunum. And most of our absorption does happen in the jejunum, but the macronutrients, like your proteins and fats and all that, but the micronutrients, a lot of them are actually absorbed right there in the duodenum, and phosphorus is one of them. So there's two processes, and this is very common with nutrients, that there's a passive and an active process. So there's a carrier that can be activated, but that's usually in low concentrations. In high concentrations, it's passive. It just goes from across the border and gets into the bloodstream without any activity. When low amounts are present, we're actually needing this transporter, this carrier, to actually carry it across. So as with most nutrients, we've got things that increase and things that decrease the absorption. And a lot of these are similar. You're going to see similarities from one to the other in the micronutrients. So leaky gut decreases, and it mainly decreases when the quantities are low because it's going to have more of an impact on the active transport. Okay. So other GI issues, dysbiosis, irritable bowel, it increased transit time, so things are going through too quickly to be fully absorbed. So gut issues really will decrease the absorption of phosphorus. Excess magnesium, calcium, and aluminum can actually pull the phosphorus out of the body or compete with the absorption. Phytates in the form of wheat bran and dried beans and other grains. So it's not just wheat bran, but it's in the form of grains. Phytase, which can break that down free and free the phosphorus from the phytic acid. Iron And we should be taking iron away from phosphorus and calcium. So if we're taking like a hydroxyapatite type of supplement or a bone building supplement, we want to take it 2 hours away from iron. Smoking seems to interfere with everything because of its effects on the body, and alcohol. So all of these things decrease. How do you increase phosphate absorption? Well, vitamin D3, which stimulates absorption in the duodenum and the jejunum, vitamin K, vitamin C, vitamin E, and boron. So when we look at bone health, we're looking at, well, what are all the nutrients that make up the bone? What are all the nutrients that are important to increase the absorption of the nutrients that make up the bone? And what are the ones that are important in the reactions that lay down the bone, to speed up lay down the bone and the breakdown of the bone as well? So how do we get it through the body? It's quickly absorbed from the intestine into the blood, and it appears in the blood within an hour after being ingested. It's found in the blood in both organic and inorganic forms. So 70% is an organic phosphate, like the phospholipids and lipoproteins, and 30% as hydrogen phospho, I can't even say what that is, but it's this, you know, hydrogen and the oxygen, and it's an oxygen in a negative cation, anion form, and then H2PO4-, and trace amounts of PO4-3-. So when we see those nomenclatures with a superscript with a number and a minus or a plus, or the absence of the plus, which would be just positive, kind of like in math, what that means is that it's a cation form. It's an ionic form. Or an anion form, a cation being a positively charged ion, and an anion being a negatively charged. So it means that it's, you know, kind of either missing electrons or has extra electrons. The ionic forms do tend to be absorbed better in general in mineral absorption. Or did I miss something? I think I might have missed something. Yeah, and then there's inorganic phosphates associated with calcium, magnesium, and sodium. So storage, well, we know that most of it's found, 85% of it's found in the bone. It's also found in the muscle. It's in equilibrium in the bone, in the circulation, in the bloodstream with the skeletal and the inorganic phosphate. So they're both going to be in balance. The inorganic phosphorus is very filterable. The plasma ranges tend to be 2.5 to 4.5, and that's what we measure when we do a blood test. The organic compounds are what's formed as an intermediate. So we get them in food, then they get broken down into the inorganic phosphorus, and then they may get metabolized into more of the organics as we're creating other molecules from them. So the concentration in the serum can depend on, of course, dietary, whether there's enough or too much, the age of the person, and what stage of growth they're in. It could also vary by time of day. Hormones play a difference, and vitamin D, the hormone form of vitamin D, the calcitriol, makes a big difference in there, and how well the kidneys are functioning to filter. So we don't necessarily, when you see a low serum phosphorus, right away think, well, we got to eat more phosphorus. There may be some other issues going on, and you're going to play detective when you're reading that blood. How's it excreted? Well, by the kidneys. And the excretion is regulated by the following hormones. This is very similar to calcium. Parathyroid hormone, vitamin D, and something called fibroblast growth factor 3. When we have a little bit of a drop in blood calcium, and that's sensed by the parathyroids, it causes an increased secretion of parathyroid hormone. And parathyroid hormone tells the kidneys not to excrete so much, so hold on to that calcium, we're low, and then increases urinary excretion of phosphorus to maintain that absorption. And that causes a stimulation of bone resorption if we can't get the levels up enough by decreasing the urinary excretion. And this whole, you know, everything in our body is this beautiful balance. And when you understand it, you know, we're not trying to manipulate people's bodies. We're not trying to strong arm the body into doing things it shouldn't or should. Where what we're doing is trying to restore balance. And we have all these delicate mechanisms that we've seen in hormone control and in mineral and vitamin control there's the down-regulation and the up-regulation of function based on the sensors that read the blood. So we're basically always reading the levels of things in the blood and making decisions about what to do, what to increase, what to decrease. And you can get a down-regulation of the function of a particular area, absorption of nutrients or hormone production, when there's the body signals or senses that there's plenty or going in on the verge of too much. And we have an upregulation, meaning the absorption is increased or the hormonal production is increased when we sense that those levels are going down. So here's another way that phosphorus is regulated. Parathyroid, which the parathyroids sit on the thyroid. There's four tiny little glands that sit on the thyroid. They're not part of the thyroid. They just sit there. And we have the control based on, you know, is there an increase in calcium? Is there a decrease in calcium, an increase in phosphorus, stimulating vitamin D. Vitamin D affects the absorption of calcium and phosphorus, organic phosphorus. And the parathyroid causes an increased absorption of calcium and a decreased absorption of the phosphorus and an increased vitamin D. So we're constantly trying to maintain this delicate balance of not too much phosphorus, not too much, not too little calcium. So how do drugs interfere? You know, you're going to see people coming into your office or talking to you in a Skype session that are on a variety of different drugs. And I think it's really important not to have a full in-depth understanding of pharmacology enough so that you'd be prescribing them, but to understand how they interact with our hormones, how they interact with the gut and absorption, and how they interact with the various nutrients. So people taking aluminum-containing antacids form aluminum phosphate, and that's not absorbable. So that's not an organic compound that the body can break down, which means, you know, we get a buildup. Proton pump inhibitors, which are used for dealing with issues with gut reflux, and they claim over-secretion of acid, but a lot of times they're misdiagnosed and misprescribed. But proton pump inhibitors may also limit the efficacy of the phosphate binder therapy in patients with kidney failure. Excessively high doses of vitamin D or analogs can result in too much phosphorus. So, you know, vitamin D, like everything else, it's kind of the Goldilocks principle. But some things, having too much, taking too much is not a problem because you'll pee or poop it out, like your B vitamins or your vitamin C or some of the other water solubles and magnesium. But some of the nutrients actually can create a problem. So too much vitamin D is not good. So vitamin D is that Goldilocks principle of getting it just right. Too little affects bones and neurotransmitters and gut function and blood-brain barrier and all that. But too much can actually cause the demineralization of bone. Potassium supplements or potassium-sparing diuretics, when you take it with the phosphorus supplements, can result in high blood levels of potassium. That's called hyperkalemia. And that can be problematic because it can affect the heart and heart rhythm. So we've got to have, you know, be really wary and really ask people about their medication history and to know how those medications are going to be dealing and interacting with their nutrients. And finally, hormone replacement therapy in postmenopausal women, and I suppose hormone replacement in perimenopausal or premenopausal when they're taken for birth control, can be associated with higher urinary phosphorus excretion, lower serum phosphorus levels. So it's just some of the studies that are out there. Just to keep those things in mind. So what's the effect of a phosphorus deficiency? Lots, okay? Lots of things can happen. Low phosphorus, it's rarely resulting in abnormality of low serum phosphorus levels. So we really want to be able to be aware of what the symptoms are because the renal absorption, reabsorption of phosphorus increases to compensate for the decreased intake. So you really have to look at what causes this. It's really, really rare. So it's not likely that you're going to see people, but you might see people who have food, what do we call those, disorders, eating disorders, right? So somebody who's anorexic, for example. So it's found in cases of near starvation. We can see it in third world countries, and we can see it in cases where people have these eating disorders. So those are things to be aware of. You see somebody come in and they're gaunt and they're really drawn, and you really want to find out what's going on there. Post-cancer, I would assume it could be a possibility too, if somebody has cachexia from the cancer treatment. Cachexia meaning loss of appetite. So there are certain inherited disorders that can lead to phosphorus deficiency, rare renal phosphorus wasting disease. And then some of the deficiency symptoms you'd want to look for: loss of appetite, muscle weakness, bone fragility, and numbness of the extremities. Well, these can be vague. We don't know. But that combination, you want to start looking at the possibility of phosphorus deficiency. Again, you're not going to see it very much. More what you're going to see is phosphorus excess when you're looking in your practice. So let's look at bone mineralization. 85% of the phosphorus is found in the bone, like we said, and it's super important for the development of the skeletal tissue. So keeping strong bones is dependent on phosphorus. Too much phosphorus can demineralize those bones, but too little can cause the weaknesses of the bones. These are the forms that we're going to find in the body, and I just listed them there. I'm not going to try to read them out. This is not a chemistry lesson, but you're going to want to see that these are forms that you might find in the body. The hydroxyapatite is what's in the bone. That's the calcium. So it's 10 molecules of calcium, of phosphorus, and 4 oxygen, 6 times. So it's basically 6 phosphoruses and 24 oxygens, and then 2 of the OH, and that's would be 2 oxygens and 2 hydrogens, and not to be confused with H2O2. OH2. And that's all the chemistry stuff that, you know, we all had to take chemistry at some point in our lives and quickly forgot it. But this is where it comes back when you're starting to understand how these molecules are formed. Most of the time in your clinical practice, you're not going to need to really get this or know this, but it's good to understand and be able to read it and recognize when you're reading some of the medical literature. What's the ratio? So calcium to phosphorus ratio should be 13:1, and it's similar to extracellular fluid, and the bone is 1.5:1. So in the serum, the level is going to be 13:1, but in the fluids, you're going to see it as 1.5. I mean, the bone is, you're going to see it 1.5:1. Okay. So what's bone metabolism influenced by? This is a repeat of what we talked about in calcium, but I thought it's worth repeating. The parathyroid stimulates the resorption of phosphate from the bone, same as calcium. The parathyroid also stimulates the excretion of phosphorus in the urine. Parathyroid also induces the urinary excretion of phosphorus, okay? So that it's enough to override the bone resorption, and it affects a net decrease in plasma levels. So the body, in theory and in optimal function, is always reading the numbers in the blood and balancing things out. And so once they get out of balance in the blood, it's indicating that there's a metabolic process at fault. Let's look at calcitriol. Calcitriol, what's that? Active form of vitamin D. In conjunction with parathyroid, it enhances the phosphate resorption from the bone. So they work in a similar fashion, the parathyroid and the vitamin D. Stimulates the phosphate absorption in the intestine through enhanced activity of alkaline phosphatase. Okay, so it stimulates that. And alkaline phosphatase, remember, is a zinc-dependent enzyme. Okay, so the calcitriol can't do its job efficiently unless there's enough zinc. Calcitonin, which is actually produced by the parafollicular cells in the thyroid gland, promotes bone mineralization. It's not really clearly understood how it all does that, but it, you know, can increase the absorption in the intestine, and there's a lot of theories about it, but there's not like a set, like we know exactly how this works. We just know what it does in the end result. Phosphorus that isn't part of the bone is going to be in the extracellular fluids, the blood or the soft tissue, and it's going to be within the cells. So it's the major anion involved with a lot of processes. So here's the thing with phosphorus. If you see low phosphorus in the blood, you want to really be looking at some of the functions that it controls. You want to be thinking, wow, are they going to have enough ATP production? Are they going to make enough phospholipids, right? So there's a lot of things that we have to be aware of when it comes to phosphorus. It's also important part of nucleic acids in DNA and RNA. Okay, there's the deoxyribo and the ribonucleic acid and these strands. They alternate with pentose sugars to form the linear backbone of the DNA and RNA. So it's important, right? DNA and RNA and repair and expression. The RNA gets expressed from the DNA. And it's important in the intermediate metabolism of energy nutrients in the form of these high phosphate bonds, which we talked about in ATP and ADP, which is an intermediary. And then uridine triphosphate is actually a substance that's involved in metabolism. And when you break it down, it is involved in the coupling of uridine monophosphate and glucose 1-phosphate to form uridine diphosphate, which is critical for the synthesis of glycogen. And glycogen is what? It's the storage form of glucose. So phosphorus is important. And the ability to make uridine triphosphate and uridine diphosphate is important for us to be able to then take the excess sugar that's in the blood through the action of pancreas producing glucagon. Glucagon then helps to make more glycogen to store in the liver and in the muscle cells. So this is an important thing for energy storage as well as energy production. So let's look at phosphorus as an intracellular second messenger and affects cellular metabolism. So, of course, part of cyclic AMP, which is important for protein kinases that are generated in response to building hormones to cell, binding hormones to cell receptors. So we really want to be able to have good receptor awareness, like, hey, let's get these hormones bound to the receptors so they can actually do their job. So the cyclic AMP is part of that. So that's the thing. And the cyclic AMP is derived from ATP, the energy currency of the cell. Then we have inositol triphosphate, which is a second messenger to trigger intracellular calcium release. And again, the actions are mediated by protein kinases. And those are particular enzymes. Cute picture. This is just showing you all the different kinds of enzymes that are dependent on phosphorus. And there's all this picture, and you see a lot of that. Like the blue is the DNA and the RNA, huge amount of that. The orange is various enzyme metabolism and inflammatory immune system redox reactions, etc. So you can see that this balance of where the phosphorus is used in the body. So phospholipids, cell membranes, right? We have phospholipids, phosphorus and lipids make that bilayer of the cell. And if those are not intact, we're not going to have the proper hormone receptor binding. We're also not going to have the proper intake and outtake from the cell. So pulling nutrients into the cell and releasing waste out of the cell can be impacted. And when we have bad lipids, right, bad fats in the diet, stiff fats, trans fats, and they get incorporated in this phospholipid bilayer, we get really stiff cell membranes, really lack of elasticity, and they're not going to be able to do their job really well. Let's see if I said enough. Oh, yeah, so some examples. I love phosphatidylcholine, inositol, and serine. And we already talked phosphatidylcholine can be helpful for memory. And you can find these in various foods. Like the phospholipids are found at very high amounts in soy, and a lot of the supplements are soy-derived, but they're also found in sunflower seeds in the lecithin part of the sunflower seeds. And you can actually buy sunflower lecithin, and I've put a lot of people on sunflower lecithin to help them get their phospholipids. It's important in acid-base balance, so it maintains the buffering within the cells. So when the filtered phosphate reacts with secreted hydrogen ions in the kidneys, it causes a release of sodium ions, removes hydrogen ions, and increases the pH, and that's what we want. Actions can be reversed to lower the pH. So it's really important as a buffering system. Again, constantly reading. We have, I see the body and all these little things, all these little people that are responsible. They're running around inside our bloodstream and they're measuring this and they're measuring that and they're giving the feedback to those who need it. Kind of like, you know, people are bean counters in corporations and say, hey, we've got this and that. We got to change the way we do this, change the way we do that. And that's constantly happening in our body, constantly happening in our body. And it's a neat way to look at it. Okay, so how do we look at phosphorus status? How do we determine, does this person have adequate phosphorus in their system? Well, the serum phosphorus is always measured as part of a routine blood chemistry. If somebody measures it, serum phosphorus is always there. But it's not a good reflection of the stores because less than 1% is in the extracellular fluid. So it's considered hypo, low phosphatemia, low phosphorus in the blood, when it's less than 3 milligrams per deciliter. High is greater than 4.5. We don't see it all that much. Vitamin D affects it. Vitamin D3, as we talked about, protein status, parathyroid hormone, parathormone-related peptide, and renal function labs. So we're looking not just at the serum, which isn't a good reflection, but we're looking at the other things that are dependent on phosphorus to see how are those functioning. You can also do functional tests. So SpectraCell takes a look inside the cell, inside the white blood cells. The NutriVal by Genova and Metametrics look inside the cells, similar to SpectraCell, slightly different process. But another one is the bone turnover test. There's NTX, and that is a test that looks at specific chemicals that are involved in bone breakdown and bone laydown, bone creation, and looking for a balance. If someone has, people think, oh, well, if the bone creation is more than the bone breakdown, that's okay. But no, they need to be in balance. Otherwise, you just keep laying down bone, and then you have old bone that doesn't get broken down, and it can be thick, brittle bone. And that's part of why what Fosamax does is it increases the lay down of the bone but doesn't allow for the decrease of the old bone. And we get these thick bones that are brittle because it's old bone. And Osteonex, which I think is Genova Diagnostics Metametrics, runs that one. Questionnaires are good because you just look for signs and symptoms. So there's really no routine biochemical method that's accurate for phosphorus. What's the RDA? Well, the RDA is in the hundreds of milligrams, right? In males, it's less than, well, females in pregnancy and breastfeeding are much higher. Breastfeeding is a lot higher. So you can see what those phosphorus RDAs are. And then we want to look at what levels would we consider to be hyperphosphatemia, which would be if we have somebody that's taking in more than 3,000, 4,000 grams, milligrams a day, that's 3 grams, 3 to 4 grams, then they can get into the level of hyperphosphatemia. We do see that people who drink a lot of soft drinks end up with hyperphosphatemia. People who eat a lot of meat and soft drinks, you know, the hot dog eating folks drinking all their soft drinks at the ballpark, those people can end up there and they get bone demineralization. They get acidic blood, well, acidic cells because the blood maintains, and they're not healthy. So it's really a matter of looking at their diet and lifestyle to determine who's at risk. Well, or what's the risk? What can happen as a result of hyperphosphatemia? You can end up with kidney disease and stones because it can calcify. Low parathyroid hormone, kidney trauma or injury, transplant. Oh, sorry. Who's at risk for hyperphosphatemia? People who have kidney diseases or stones. I'm going to just write that note down. That 38. All right. So who's at risk for hyperphosphatemia? Okay, so it's people that have kidney disease or kidney stones. It's people with low parathyroid hormone, people who have had kidney trauma or injury, who are transplant recipients, dialysis. So you can see this a lot has to do with the kidneys, right? People are at risk when their kidneys aren't functioning. Excessive soft drink or highly processed foods. And then excessive uses of enemas or laxatives that contain phosphates. So that's where the risk comes in. So some of the symptoms of hyperphosphatemia, too much phosphorus. In acute cases, it's going to be joint pain, muscle cramps, spasms, fatigue, numbness in the mouth, around the mouth, periorbital numbness, pain in the bones, itching, pruritus, nausea, vomiting, or rash. So if somebody has had an acute, acute exposure to phosphorus, it's usually because they end up with symptoms of low calcium. And these are there. So if you see a combination of that, you may want to ask about acute exposure. Acute exposure isn't as common, but there we go. So here are all the adverse effects of excess phosphorus. So you have demineralization of the bone, inhibition of parathyroid, which affects that, decrease renal synthesis of calcitriol, that's what it affects, vascular calcification. So the deposition of some of these deposits in the bloodstream. So a lot of times, in the blood vessels, because a lot of times people don't have enough of the minerals in the bone and their bones are weak, but they have plenty in the blood and then they get deposited in soft tissue and in blood vessel linings, which is not very good. Increased adipose tissue, increasing triglycerides can lead to obesity, insulin resistance, Alzheimer's causing the plaques, tumor promotion. So this is serious if somebody is chronically eating too much phosphorus. And that's something you need to warn people about. They may not notice acute symptoms because they're not getting into that, you know, super massive amounts like they might get in an exposure. But they are still having a problem with their metabolism that may show up later and they may not even see it connected. So that's why we do very thorough histories with people. We really look at what are they taking in, what's their food, what's their junk food exposure, how much good food are they taking in, and really help them to see not just what's related to symptoms they're presenting with, but what the risk factors are if they keep it up. So bone mineral density, we talked a little bit about this in calcium as well. When people are at risk for osteoporosis, we can do a DEXA or DXA scan, and we can do CT scans, which are less precise. Where do we get it? It's abundant in the diet. The plant sources, cashews, sunflower seeds, lentils, and almonds. The animal sources, chicken, turkey, beef, halibut, sardines, salmon, dairy, tuna, and dairy. So it's a lot more prevalent in the animal kingdom, but there's still, we really don't run the risk of deficiencies of calcium, more run the risk of excess. There are some herbs high in phosphorus. So if you've got somebody who's eating massive amounts of some of these herbs, which is rare, but then they can end up with high phosphorus. But these are good sources, just general. You see that there's plenty of places where you can get it. Lots of good herbs and herb teas and herb tinctures and all that. Here's a list of the food sources of phosphorus and kind of looking at them, whole grains versus refined grains. The phytates actually reduce the absorption. So even though the whole grains have 85, that the refined only have 33, they probably have a similar amount of phosphorus because of the phytates still in the whole grains, which is in the bran usually. The vegetables, you know, we've got dark green leafies have some, red and orange vegetables have some. Now remember, we're looking at around 700 milligrams a day. So a half a cup of these vegetables. But, you know, if you have somebody who's eating a smoothie and they fill their Vitamix with 4 cups of greens, we're talking 8 times this. So we're talking 8 times, that's 32. We're getting a fair amount of phosphorus. I don't believe that there's a risk for getting too much phosphorus from eating these plant foods. But when we look at the animal foods and those kind of foods, the meats and beans, an ounce is 63. You know, we compound that up. We add that to all in the milk. People are eating like drinking 4 cups of milk a day, puts them over 1,000 on just the phosphorus, and it becomes problematic. So we just have to be careful what people are eating. How do we supplement? Well, we don't usually supplement, right? We usually plenty in the diet. So there's elemental, which is very toxic, but homeopaths will dilute it down and they use it for specific remedies. The inorganics, not toxic at typical doses, but again, we don't see a lot of this. We don't really need to supplement with phosphorus. Dibasic potassium, monobasic potassium phosphate, dibasic sodium phosphate. So it's bound, it's the potassium or sodium bound with the phosphorus, and there's either one, two, or three molecules. Phosphatidylcholine and serine have other, this is a really good source of phosphorus and good source of the phospholipids. They're actually formed phospholipids because those are really important for brain and hormone function. Can actually take phosphorus topically. It combines with other compounds. There are some drugs that are used, and it's used in for acne. Clindamycin, which is an antibiotic that's used topically, can be used for phosphate, but the phosphates can get into the system. Enemas and laxatives. So if somebody's constipated and they've been years of doing lots of enemas with phosphates and laxatives, especially the Fleet enemas. And athletes might use phosphate supplements before competitions to help reduce muscle pain and fatigue. Really probably, you know, a lot of them use ATP or ADP kind of supplements, or they use the phospholipids. So what's the phosphorus calcium ratio? The serum ratio is 10 to 4. A high ratio of phosphorus to calcium sensitizes the body and increases inflammation. So we really want to make sure that balance is kept. When the phosphorus is too high, we get frequent colds and flu, sensitive skin, cavities right near the gum line, red rimmed eyes, low blood pressure, and they're sensitive to pain. So think about these things. They may be out of balance, and usually when they're out of balance, it's too little calcium and too much phosphorus. So we want to maintain that ratio. So I've got some resources. There's some really good stuff in the book. All the chemical stuff is in the book. If you want to look at calcium and phosphorus and all those other things, there's some really good resources. The Better Bones blog, Susan Brown, or betterbones.com is another place. Edward Group, he has some really good stuff, and he has lists of phosphorus foods. Walter Last has some phosphorus foods. The Linus Pauling Institute and the University of Maryland Medical Center. So if you want to go deeper with this and you want to really dig in, these are some of the places you can go. So I hope this has been informative and not too geeky technical, and that you got some really practical clinical information about phosphorus.